Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thank you, Ian.
And today, the reimposition of sanctions against Iran that were lifted under the 2015 nuclear deal have gone into effect. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has rather defiantly said, "We will proudly break the sanctions." But there's no question that these sanctions are going to have a terrible impact on a country that's already reeling with a currency in free fall, prices going through the roof, women taking to the streets, chafing against the strictures of the rule by the mullahs, etc. It does feel as if Iran is ready for some kind of social explosion. What's your feeling on this?
Well, yes. I mean, the domestic discontent is very deep. It's vast. It goes into large sections of the population, particularly young people, students, the middle class. We're approaching the 40th year of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and it broadly, I think, has been a failure in terms of, you know, meeting the demands and hopes and expectations of the large swaths of the Iranian society. You know, I could go into detail, but I don't think that these sanctions that Trump and Bolton are imposing on Iran are going to produce the type of revolution that they hope, for two main reasons. Number one, I think there is no appetite for a violent revolution in Iran. There is a broad, I think, consensus that despite the difficult internal economic conditions, the repression of the regime, that there's no appetite for another bloody revolution. Iranians have experienced a lot of blood and repression. So there's a demand for political change, but there's also a demand for peaceful political change, not violent revolution. And secondly, the regional environment, you know, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, and farther afar in Libya has produced, I think, a set of lessons for Iranians that they don't want to turn their country into a failed and collapsed state like those countries that I just listed. So I think Bolton and Trump are dreaming big dreams that these punitive sanctions, which are going to take a huge toll on the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, not the regime, that these are going to lead to some sort of regime change and an expansion of American influence in the region.
Well, clearly there is a compact of sorts between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United States in putting the squeeze on Iran. It's not just the United States, and we don't know the extent to which the tail is wagging the dog, since this administration seems to be so deferential, not just to Vladimir Putin, but also to Benjamin Netanyahu. But the really scandalous and obvious fact is that Trump and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, have thrown their lot in with MBS, this disgraced thug, murderous little kleptocrat and autocrat, who they joined in this public relations campaign to suggest that he was some kind of great reformer. That is all blown up in their face, but they're doubling down, the Trump-Kushner crowd. They're even more in support of MBS, and I'm sure a lot of money has changed hands. So that seems to be what's driving it, as far as I can see. And it's just extraordinary. Not that the regime under Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guard Corps are not an odious group of kleptocrats themselves, but by comparison, we're really backing the wrong side here in terms of throwing our lot in with this murderous little dictator with absolute impunity, who's shown that he has absolute impunity and no regard for human rights, and yet he's our champion in the Middle East. He's the horse we're backing.
No, I would agree with that broad characterization, Ian. I would just add that I'm uncomfortable with the phrase, we're backing the wrong side. I think, as you just outlined, both sides are odious, both sides are repressive, and both sides are, you know, poor options that we should be struggling against. I do agree that the odious, you know, coalition of MBS, the Saudi Crown Prince, Netanyahu, the Emirates, General el-Sisi in Egypt, etc., is a much more, a much more disgusting group of characters who've sowed a lot of mayhem in the region. But I don't think the correct response is to try and somehow diminish our critique of the internal repression that the Islamic Republic of Iran has imposed on its people for the last 40 years. I think we should be able to, operate on multiple tracks. And so I see this as a sort of an opportunity for people who are very interested and concerned about moving the Middle East in a better direction to really shine a spotlight on some of these members of this coalition that Saudi Arabia, Kushner, and Benjamin Netanyahu have put together to highlight what they are doing in the region and how it's really catastrophic. It's not just their policy on Iran, which I think is going to fundamentally just, disenfranchise and hurt the average Iranian citizen while not really affecting the regime, but it's in, just the broader regional landscape, which is on the verge of another explosion because of this deepening stranglehold of authoritarianism that is suffocating the region, and unfortunately is being backed primarily by the United States under Donald Trump, but also the Europeans. And this is also a story that I would highlight. It cannot be all laid at the doorstep of Donald Trump. I mean, the Obama administration and previous administrations basically supported the regional authoritarian order with very few, changes in policies. So, we're looking at a very dim and very sort of grim Middle East today with very few prospects for optimism in the near future, and that's just the reality we have to deal with.
So back to the sanctions. Obviously, the real tool here is the Brussels-based SWIFT network, which is necessary to make international payments and payments for oil. And the main customers, of course, for Iran's oil are China, then followed by India, South Korea, Turkey, Italy, France, Japan, and the UAE. And while the United States wouldn't have much influence over China, some over India, and some over Turkey, but obviously has a lot of influence over South Korea, Italy, France, and Japan. But it turns out that the Trump administration has given them all a grace period before the sanctions are imposed, with the exception, of course, of the Europeans. And this is clearly designed to make sure that the price of oil doesn't go up before the elections. So I see a very cynical ploy there on the part of the Trump administration. He says he wants maximum sanctions, but when he rolls them out, they really do have a major caveat.
That's a great point, Ian, and I think it just highlights the incoherence of this policy that Trump and Pompeo and Bolton are pursuing with respect to Iran. The fact that they've given exemptions to these eight countries, undermines their desire to really affect Iran's oil exports. Under Obama, there was a comprehensive sanctions regime that had buy-in from the entire international community over Iran's nuclear program. And those sanctions were very effective precisely because they were international and they were focused on bringing Iran to the negotiating table. These ones that we're seeing right now have a lot of holes, a lot of, exemptions. And it's, it's seriously in doubt whether they're going to really, bring about the desired goals that the Trump administration is articulating in terms of trying to change Iran's regional behavior. I think what my own reading of this is, a lot of this is simply driven by a narrow ideological group of actors, both in Washington and in the region, who simply want to punish Iran without any serious plan to change Iran's behavior. And so, I would draw your listeners' attention to a very important, report that came out last week by the International Crisis Group, called The Illogic of U.S. Sanctions Snapback on Iran, where they looked at the last 40 years of sanctions on Iran, and they said that it's very difficult to find a correlation between Iran's economic performance and sanctions that are placed on Iran's economy and its regional policy. That the nature of Iran's regional role is a low-intensity warfare. It doesn't invest a lot of money. And despite sanctioning the regime does have a lot of resources, has a lot of, international bank deposits, ways of getting around sanctions that can still facilitate its regional policy. And so that report is quite detailed. It's by a respected independent, group that monitors, questions of conflict around the world, and it casts, I think, a very sort of dark shadow over this plan that the Trump administration is pursuing. And I think at the end of the day, the tragedy will be that it'll be, you know, as I said earlier, the Iranian people who have no say over their government's regional policy, over their government's internal repression, who will pay the big price here because of the deep ideological, you know, zealotry that we're seeing in the White House today.
But now, Hashimi, when you talk about ideological zealotry, you could also be describing the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the Pashtun Basij militia, etc. They're the ones that keep the Iranian people in line, and they're going to be busy more and more as more and more young Iranians and particularly women take to the streets. And one of the things that chafes the average Iranian is that how much money Iran is spending on Hezbollah and supporting Syria's dictator Bashar al-Assad. The State Department says that since 2012, Iran has spent $16 billion supporting Hezbollah and Bashar al-Assad. So, and of course, talking about ideologues, I mean, one of the problems with the Iranian regime is that they don't seem to care about international law and norms. They go and assassinate their enemies wherever they can find them. And there was recently an arrest made in Denmark of an Iranian hit team out to kill an Iranian dissident. So does the leadership get the message that this is one of the reasons why they're incredibly unpopular?
No, they don't get the message, largely because authoritarian regimes tend to, and particularly leaders of authoritarian regimes, tend to live in their own bubble. You're absolutely correct that the leadership of the Islamic Republic does have its own ideological zealotry that I think drives a lot of its policies. And I think it's simply trying to, quite with a lot of sophistication, you know, spin an internal narrative that is really rooted in themes of Iranian nationalism, that Iran is being subjected to external aggression by imperial powers, and trying to rally as many people as it can around the flag of Iranian nationalism in response to Trump's new aggressive policy. Now, that's an argument that no longer, I think, is believable by many Iranians. But like all authoritarian regimes, you don't need majority support. You just need a minority group of people who are willing to come into the streets when you call on them. And then, of course, you need the heavy hand of repression to keep everyone else in line. And then you need enough financial resources to pay off your loyalists. And the Islamic Republic, despite these sanctions that are being posed on it, still has those, you know, resources at its disposal, which is one reason why I'm so critical of Trump's foreign policy, because I think it's doing the exact opposite of its stated intent to try and allegedly help the Iranian people bring about political change. I mean, if that was the goal, I think the Obama administration's plan of economic engagement, of decreasing tensions, trying to strengthen the middle class, trying to embolden precisely those people who were at the core of the 2009 Green Movement protests and who brought the regime really to a breaking point almost, that's the better way forward, not by impoverishing, sanctioning, and pursuing these types of policies, which ironically actually don't really affect the upper echelons of the regime. They have, you know, sufficient patron clientele networks, smuggling networks, foreign bank reserves to sustain themselves. So I think ultimately at the end of the day, it's just going to be counterproductive. And, you know, ironically, I think the biggest beneficiaries of the current Trump policy is going to be the hardliners who control the Islamic Republic.
And that's, of course, pretty much what Trump did with Cuba. I mean, you know, by cutting off ties that were developed under Obama, brokered by Pope Francis, the hardliners are back in even more control. The people have sort of in more despair, and they're suffering more. I just don't understand what motivates people like Bolton, except I think in Bolton's case and in Trump's case, they're kind of bitter about the fact, particularly Bolton, that he's sort of so much on the fringe of the foreign policy elite that he's got something to prove. I don't know. What do you think motivates this guy? Because he's so boneheaded. Ideologues are so ridiculous in foreign policy because they're so predictable. You can play them like a violin.
Yeah. You know, that's a good question. I think you really need a clinically trained psychiatrist to really answer your question comprehensively. But my own view is that Part of it has to do with simply trying to distinguish themselves, the Trump administration, from what Obama was doing. So, you know, tearing up the Iran nuclear accord does that. But I think a lot of the motivation, this applies less to Bolton, but more to, I think, Trump and his inner circle. You know, as we see domestically, they really want to cater to their core base of supporters in the country. And so by pursuing these, you know, cosmetic, seemingly bold and aggressive, you know, positions that really are about posturing, not about really bringing about any results, they accomplish that quite significantly. There's no serious, you know, long-term, I think, calculation of, you know, how to, you know, advance a serious policy agenda, working multilaterally and thinking through the different sort of aspects of a plan. It's really short-term. It's for immediate sort of, you know, headlines. It's the posture. It's to sort of, you know, cater to your base, distinguish yourselves from, you know, the previous administration, and that's it. So I think that's really the policy here. It's really responding to these narrow lobby groups, of which it's not just, you know, catering to the base support in the Republican Party, but also it's really the influential, you know, voices and actors in the D.C., Washington, D.C. lobby circuit who are on the payroll of different Gulf states, who are deeply indebted to and are closely connected with, you know, the passionate supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington, i.e. AIPAC, who are pushing a lot of this agenda, simply, I think, for very narrow short-term calculations, but nothing long-term. And I think the Cuba analogy that you pointed to is actually a very apt comparison.
Well, just in closing, I think this administration, a more accurate way to look at them is they are completely pay-to-play. This is a mercenary, mercantile, corrupt group of people. They come out of Trump's record is so shady, it's beyond belief, with Russian money laundering and mobbed up connections, etc. We could spend the rest of the day talking about that. But the pay-to-play aspect seems so clear here. The Saudis, MBS and Jared Kushner made some kind of financial deal. There's all kinds of people looking into it. And we know that Sheldon Adelson was one of the biggest donors, if not the biggest donor, to Donald Trump, and he's getting his payback. Isn't that a big part of it? Just to simply, you know, that if you give Trump money and adoration, you own him.
No, I totally agree. I think it's completely transactional. With Trump itself, it's pretty clear that it's ego-driven, that he doesn't have any, I think, particular commitment to any sort of values or vision beyond his own personal sort of reputation, which is why he sort of really loved the summit with the North Korean dictator, because it got him a lot of media attention. He sort of hinted, I don't know if you recall, Ian, but in the context of Iran, he sort of hinted at the in September at the UN General Assembly meetings of the heads of state that if Rouhani, he called him a good guy, wanted to reach out to him, he would be open to such a meeting, I think really driven by just the positive press coverage. And then, of course, the underlying economic corruption with all of these oligarchs and, you know, corrupt, you know, players in the international business scene really solidifies Trump's, you know, I think, you know, his political base and how he thinks about politics. There's nothing here that's in the interest of the American people, of international peace and security, of more stability in the Middle East. I think when history is written about this period, Ian, I think this is going to be one of the darkest days, not just in terms of American domestic politics, but in terms of U.S. foreign policy as well.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.